Members of the committee will come to order, and our first item, our first business item is the approval of the minutes, and I believe Representative Christensen, you have a motion for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move to add to the 2:13 minutes that the motion was prevailed to Representative Long's Bill HF 689 at the bottom of the second page.
Very well. So Representative Christensen moves adoption of the minutes from, make sure I have the right date, February 13th, with the verbal amendment as you just stated. Discussion? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Well, I can barely hear that. Did anyone else hear that? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Well, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Members, we've got basically two sections to this hearing. The first part is to, and by the way, you know, today we're going to be focused on issues related to sex crimes and to survivors of those crimes. We've got some really good bills that members from both sides of the aisle have been working on for quite a while, and I'm really looking forward to hearing the testimony for those today. Some of that involves bills that we debated and passed last year, and as I stated previously, it's my desire to honor the bills that we did last year without relitigating them if we're receiving them through the process of the 4.20 with the same language and then to pass those forward. Some of those bills are going to need small technical amendments, primarily just to adjust the dates. So it won't be unusual to have those bills with some technical amendments before us. The intent is to move those bills forward with minimal additional testimony, debate, or substantive amendments. Again, because our intent is to fulfill the bills that we all passed last year, but for whatever reason, didn't make it to the final finish line. So with that, members, we have House File 734, Representative Gomez. And you feel free to come forward, Representative Gomez. Hopefully, we'll only have you here for a few seconds. And the chair then will move that House File 734 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And Representative Gomez, there is an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's really purely a technical amendment of adjusting a date. And so the chair will then move the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Same sign. Motion prevails. So now the bill is before us as amended. If there's any burning questions, I'm not going to get in the way of members doing that. But again, we litigated this bill pretty extensively last year, passed it forward. We have the same language before us with the addition of the technical date change language. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but I just wanted to offer my undying support for this, and I think it's incredibly important as a tool to explain to victims that we really do care, and as long as it takes, it takes, and lifting that statute of limitations would do that. And I understand that when DNA is present, there is not a statute of limitations, but I think for the other case, it's important to also lift the statute of limitations in those cases as well. So, and it was a piece that I had in my HANA law bill that we had earlier last year. So thank you for doing this, and it's incredibly important. I remember that day very clearly when we had victim survivors that came and shared their testimony and how impactful this would be. So I think it would send a loud message to victim survivors all over that we do care, we hear them, and that as long as it takes, it takes. So thank you, Representative Gomez.
Representative Gomez.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, and just thanks back to you for your long-term support of this effort that I'm new to, and, you know, being a co-author on this bill and all of the ways that you advocate for us centering survivors and victims in our work in this committee and this body. So thank you very much.
Very well. Any further questions, comments? If not, the chair then renews his motion that House File 734, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members, and thank you, Representative Gomez. And you might as well stay there because the next bill is House File 2586. And members, this bill also falls in the same category as House File 734. So again, it's not my intent to relitigate this bill extensively. There are some amendments, however. So let me first move. The chair moves House File 2586 be re-referred to the General Register. And Representative Gomez, this is a U visa certification related bill requesting timely processing of requests for movement towards certifying the request for these visas. There is an amendment. It's the DE amendment, and let me explain what we're doing here, members. This delete all amendment deletes the language from this bill, 2586, but hold on. It inserts the language from House File 2367, which was a Representative Dean bill, and additionally makes technical amendments to update the dates referenced in the bill. The language in the DE, apart from the changes in those dates, is a clone of the Dean bill heard by both Public Safety and Judiciary committees and eventually pass off the floor in the omnibus bill. It is our intention to pass this version of the bill in order to align this language with an author in the other body. Again, it's our intention not to rehear the bill as to honor as much as to honor the work that we did last year. So with that, the chair moves the DE amendment. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 2586, as amended, is before us. Representative Gomez, any brief and good words for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like you said, I mean, this is really just to try to standardize some of these procedures across the state with respect to the way that we deal with victims of crime who are eligible for U visas. Different jurisdictions are dealing with them in different ways, so we want to kind of try to bring some uniformity to that process.
Very well. Members, all in favor of the
Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I think I'm going to request a roll call on this bill.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Any further questions? With that, the clerk will take the roll on House File 2586 as amended.
Cool. Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Christensen?
Yes.
Considine?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Edelson? Edelson, Howard, Johnson,
no,
Lesh,
aye,
Long, Lucero,
no,
Miller,
no,
Moeller,
yes.
Nash?
No.
Sorry, Nash?
No.
O'Neill?
No.
Pinto?
Yes.
Poston?
No.
Novotny? Going back down the list again. Long?
Yes.
Edelson? Edelson? Howard? Okay.
Very well, members, on a vote of 8 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and committee members.
Members, we're now going to move to House File 3218. Representative Bowman. Senator Mueller moves that House File 3218 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment here, the A1 amendment.
Representative Mueller moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Quick description.
Yes, the A1 amendment just includes the Chief Law Enforcement Officer into the rest of the bill.
Very well. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Mueller, House File 3218 as amended is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3218 requires the BCA to conduct investigations when a peace officer is accused of sexual assault. This bill is the result of an experience of Elizabeth Sampson Lee, who you'll hear from momentarily, and the issues surrounding the lack of justice for survivors of sexual assault. Over the last couple of years, with the Star Tribune's Deny Justice series and the Me Too movement, we have heard about the lack of justice for survivors. As we will hear from Representative O'Neill later, this continues with the destruction of rape kits and the lack of testing. Last year, this committee did good bipartisan work to address some of these issues, including the working group that's looking at rewriting the criminal sexual conduct statutes and requiring law enforcement agencies to have model policies for investigating these cases. This bill continues that good work by requiring that when a peace officer is accused of sexual assault, the investigation of that allegation will be conducted by the BCA. Now, thankfully, we don't think that this is a common occurrence, and there are agencies that do send these investigations on to other agencies. But we think having the BCA conduct all investigations provides a consistency to the investigations, will be less of a barrier for survivors who want to report the assault, will provide for more information about when such crimes are alleged, and will result in impartial investigations. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just note that the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault supports this bill, and I would turn it over to my testifier.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Sampson Lee. I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my testimony today for this crucial bill. In September 2012, nearly 4 months into my employment at a sheriff's office, a sergeant I barely knew rubbed my buttocks in front of a coworker. I immediately reported this to my supervisor with no response. 3 weeks later, the same sergeant sexually assaulted me in my cubicle over the lunch hour when he knew no one else was around. He trapped me at my desk and stroked my vagina over my gray slacks while his holstered service weapon dug into my left shoulder. Again, I reported to my supervisor immediately upon her return from her lunch break. The sheriff denied me my right to file an official report and insisted they would conduct their own investigation. Instead, this resulted in a cover-up, harassment, retaliation, and hostile work environment. I was told by officers from a different law enforcement agency that at the time of my assault, I was victim number 30-something of this sergeant, including employees and community members. He got an alleged letter in his file. Compromised mental health and life circumstances kept me there for 18 months afterward. I spent that time documenting their abuses to prove my case, though no one ever denied the sexual assault happened. Instead, I was told, "It was an accident. Creepy is not a crime. Sometimes he gets so busy he doesn't realize what he's doing. He's had a hard time in his personal life. It's not like he reached up your skirt, only because I wasn't wearing a skirt that day. I contacted other agencies to see if they would take a report, investigate, and stop this sexual predator. I was told there was no avenue to report. In August 2013, after I discovered my personal information was accessed through DVS by a sheriff's office employee they refused to identify, I found an attorney and filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This process lasted 3 years and ended with a forced settlement. That November, over 4 years after the assault, I filed the complaint with the Post Board to take action on the sergeant's peace officer's license. In February 2017, an outside agency was directed to conduct an investigation they had 30 days to complete. In the end, the investigator wanted to charge the sergeant with sexual assault, but couldn't because the statute of limitations had expired on a crime I immediately reported. Instead, the sergeant retired with benefits 10 months later. In August 2018, a year and a half after the Post Board investigation, I was blindsided by a phone call from the executive director. Though a date had been set for an administrative hearing before a judge, he informed me the board settled my case with the now-retired sergeant who surrendered his already expired peace officer's license. The bottom line is this. Had I not endured and documented 18 months of workplace abuse as retaliation for reporting my sexual assault, an attorney would not have taken my case, nor would the EEOC have allowed it to proceed. Had I not been embroiled with the EEOC for 3 years and had legal documents to back my case, the Post Board would not have moved forward with my complaint, the first of its kind, I'm told, that lasted 2 years. The systems forced me into silence from September 2012 to August 2018. It bears repeating. An investigator wanted to charge my uniformed perpetrator with the crime, but the statute of limitations had expired on a sexual assault I immediately reported in a place that is sworn to protect and serve. There is no official report on file because the sheriff denied me my right to do so.
Thank you for your powerful testimony, Ms. Sampson Lee. I think I most likely speak for everyone here that that's a horrifying story for us to hear from any citizen, much less from a public servant in our law enforcement community. Thank you for the courage of you to share that with us today. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any other testifiers, so I'm open for questions.
Very well. Members, questions? Representative Polston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulder, does this apply to officers on duty and off duty?
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to defer to House Research for that.
Very well. Mr. Deagle.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill would apply to on-duty and off-duty conduct. Mr. Chair and members, the bill would cover both on-duty and off-duty misconduct on behalf of peace officers.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Johnson.
One thing we've talked about a lot in other committees as well, dealing with, and in this committee, is dealing with the tribal police departments. In the bill, the definition for law enforcement officers, a peace officer employed by a federally recognized tribe. Just wondering if you're aware of any jurisdictional issues with the BCA investigating a peace officer on a federal law enforcement agency.
Representative Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for that. So the peace officer definition is coming directly from existing statute 626.84, but I guess I would again defer to House Research for your specific question.
Why don't we do that and give Mr. Diebold a second as he looks through the statute.
Chair Mariani, I got a little clarification on the question as well. It would be on a tribal officer, not a federal officer.
Mr. Diebold.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know for certain the, other than the fact that the Post Board does license these officers, and so they've consented to state jurisdiction in that regard.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Debo. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this forward. And I am so sorry. That is just a horrendous story. No woman should go through that. No person should go through that. And I think if it had been reversed and you had done it to him, right? Yeah. Action, he probably would have twisted your arm behind your back and thrown you on the floor or something, right? So, but in any case, I think this is another example of why we also need to eliminate the statute of limitations, because that is so incredibly problematic. And here is a great example of that as well. And of course, the inherent conflict is glaring of why we wouldn't want to do this. I mean, what I'm trying to say is, why would a police force want to investigate their own? I think it should be at the BCA. The conflict is just glaring, is what I'm trying to say. So I'm fully supportive of this, and I just, again, am aghast and just amazed at the conduct of some individuals and how much it affected you for years and years and years. So thank you for your bravery and your testimony.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill. I think that Subdivision 2, having the BCA do the investigation, makes a great deal of sense. And I'm just so thankful for you sharing your story and for how you stood up by sharing your story. You're standing up for so many other people, so thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Thank you for coming forward. I can't imagine the incredible amount of courage and intestinal fortitude you have shown through this and coming here today talking about it. I'm not sure I'd be that brave. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Considine. Any further questions? With that, a roll call has been requested. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, to the testifier, I'm very disturbed that you had to go through that. Not only disturbed at that officer that did that, I'm even more frustrated at the sheriff for allowing. I trust that he's no longer the chief law enforcement officer of your county, and I hope you pursue whatever action you can against him, because he should not have been sheriff. And I like the concept of this bill, but I do notice, I'm just wondering with the author, how, if she's found a Senate author yet, because there is no Senate companion, and without that, it's going to be very difficult to get this through. And I know the Senate is being very careful, and just, I don't think they're planning to do too much already, but I'm just, hopefully you have a Senate author figured out to get this put through.
Representative Johnson, that would certainly be disturbing news to this chair, that continued foot dragging on the other body would happen this year. I can't think of another bill in which both bodies and both parties can come on full agreement to. And I would certainly hope that they will overcome whatever it is that's going on over there that doesn't allow them to address the concerns and the realities that our citizens face and our public servants and law enforcement face and our state. Representative Mueller, do you have an author?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, yes, I do. Senator Latz is going to be carrying it over there, and I've been trying to get in a meeting with the chair of the Public Safety Committee and the other body to talk to him about this as well.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mueller, thanks for doing this. Father of three daughters, husband for 30 years, and this just drives me mad that somebody who swore to protect and serve would do this. So from my perspective, let's make this happen and make it harsh. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Further questions? If not, a roll call has been called. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Considine?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Howard? Howard? Johnson?
Yes.
Lesh?
Aye.
Long?
Yes.
Lucero? Lucero? Miller?
Yes.
Moeller?
Yes.
Nash?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Emphatically yes.
Pinto?
Yes.
Poston?
Yes.
Novotny?
Yes.
I'll go back down the list. Howard? Howard? Lucero? Lucero?
Very well. At a vote of 15 ayes and 2 absent and 0 nays, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Thank you, Ms. Sampson-Lee.
Thank you.
Very well. Members, House File 3070, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto moves that House File 3070 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I believe, Representative Pinto, we're going to lay this over.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. Yes, I'm just moving it to put it before the body, but I think it is being laid over then.
Very well. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As members are aware, my work outside the legislature as a prosecutor, I've done a fair amount of work in prosecuting sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. There's a lot that we will want to do in addressing that area of the law. The bill before you was brought to me by the Central Minnesota Human Trafficking Task Force, who noticed a number of changes that need to be made in this area of the law, and so we'll be hearing from them as to the need for them. I wonder, Mr. Chair, if it makes sense. I guess I'll just note for members that the bill contains a kind of a collection of proposals. We could either have House Research walk through them, or maybe simply we could have the testifiers talk about the need for each of them and then go with members' questions, whatever you'd like to do, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we hear from the testifiers first?
Okay.
And then we'll do a technical walkthrough. It's a good recommendation.
Okay. We're going to start with the Chief, Mr. Chair.
Chief, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and excuse me, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to stop in here. I'll keep my comments brief, but Dave Benchwood, I'm police chief for the city of Waite Park.
Pinterman?
I'm sorry?
Your last name again, sir?
Bentrud.
Bentrud. Boy, I really heard that wrong.
T-R-U-D.
How do you spell that again?
B-E-N-T-R-U-D.
Very well. Thank you, Chief.
And I think the last time I had an opportunity to speak in front of this committee, we were looking for funding for our task force. That was about 3 years ago, and we were successful. Thank you for help this committee to get that done. We are just almost starting our third year of operation. And in the course of the last 2 years, our work in central Minnesota has probably been the most gratifying that I've been a part of when it comes to multi-jurisdictional, multidisciplinary collaboration when it comes to not only going after traffickers, but reducing the demand side and helping victims as well. And in the course of that work, as Representative Pinto indicated, we identified some issues or some gaps that we would like or asking that you to consider as a remedy. Strength County Attorney Janelle Kendall and Ole Tweeden, who's chief of the criminal divisions for Stearns County, are here as well. And currently our task force operates. We have investigators from the Waite Park Police Department, St. Cloud Police Department, Stearns County Sheriff's Office, as well as staff from the Stearns County Attorneys. So, thank you.
We can turn things to the County Attorney, Mr. Chair, if you're willing.
Very well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janelle Kendall, I am the Stearns County Attorney. And again, thank you to this body and the entire legislature for assisting us. Representative Miller has been at the table at a number of our task force meetings from the beginning. And obviously, Representative Pinto is ahead of us and was, in fact, the pioneer in the state of Minnesota on prosecuting these cases. So we have learned much from him, also from the Washington County Attorney's Office and their task force. We've prosecuted about 30 traffickers so far in Stearns County over the last 3 years, between 200 and 300 buyers. And in the process of these cases and trying these cases to juries, we have noticed a couple things that we would like to ask for your assistance on. The first is, for the most part, the traffickers that we're running into are career criminals. One of the things that we put before the legislature today is adding the trafficking offenses to the list of violent crimes. Right now, trafficking is actually not a violent crime in the state of Minnesota. So the extra sentences that we can pursue on persons with significant criminal histories, we need to fix that. Once this is considered a violent crime, not only does it give us the ability to pursue a dangerous offender statute with a lot more years of sentencing involved, and we are asking you to increase those maximum sentences, but it also puts this in a different place on a criminal's history for future reference. So we're looking for increases in the statutory maximum, which are outlined in the bill, so I won't go into those details, but also for adding trafficking specifically to the violent crime designation so that that could be used at sentencing. I should tell the legislature we have had the opportunity to have a trial and a statutory maximum sentence on a trafficker in Stearns County in which two survivors were able and willing to testify. It was, again, one of the most powerful things that we have seen as professionals in the public safety realm. Second is the issue of buyers. As I said, we've prosecuted between 200 and 300 buyers in the city of St. Cloud, some of them multiple times. The strong community reaction that we have had to the sentences and how these matters are handled is reflective in our request today. And I know that Representative Pinto has seen this as well. Right now, if a buyer solicits sex in a public place, it's a gross misdemeanor, but in a private place, only a misdemeanor. And that's a really old-fashioned view of what sex trafficking is where it happens, would have any impact at all on what the sentence for that offense might be. So we ask that buyers be globally charged with gross misdemeanors. And additionally, I'm sorry to report that we've convicted some people, two and pending three times, the same buyers. So to not only increase that penalty to recognize that this is a more serious crime, we also ask the legislature to give us the option of enhancing this to a felony when the same person is convicted multiple times within a 10-year period of buying sex. Finally, we have noticed approximately 5-time greater demand for persons under the age of 15. In the work that we have now done on sex trafficking and who these buyers are, who these sellers are, and the challenges that these victims face, we do find that the demand increases significantly if the ad is for a person who is 15 years or younger. Right now, that's only a 3-year felony in the state of Minnesota. Let's make that a 5-year felony for starters, and we'll report back to this body. We've got about 15 of those so far. So this has been an unfortunately big area for us to get into. We had no idea, and when the Ramsey County Attorney's Office had told us that they were seeing victims from St. Cloud in their files in Ramsey County, they were absolutely right. And we are honored to be able to have taken on this important topic. To Representative Pinto for bringing this forward. These are basically technical changes, but the difference that this will make in sentencing and our ability to address buyers would be very significant.
Thank you, County Attorney Kendall. Did I hear this right, that 30 traffickers convicted in the last year?
Yes, Ms. In the last 3 years.
In the last 3 years. Okay. Very well. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this forward. And, you know, this is also an area of great concern of mine, and I've done a lot of study looking at some of the RAIN statistics and others. And what is startling to me is sort of the average age that I'm, the latest information that I've gotten of boys and girls when they are trafficked being 12. The last thing I looked at was 12 for boys and 13 for girls. Are you seeing that? You're seeing that as well. I just want to see what they're seeing here in Minnesota and in St. Cloud, because those are national numbers, which are shocking, that the average age of a sex trafficked child is 12 for a boy and 13 for a girl. I just want to hear, is that something that you're seeing in St. Cloud as well?
I guess I'll just note, thank you, Mr. Chair, the latest from Stearns County. I just want to note that my understanding has always been that the average age for people who start in prostitution under the age of 18, so not just trafficking more broadly for selling sex, that if you start as a minor, the average age of starting is 13, is what I've always been aware of. So very similar to what you're saying, Representative O'Neill. But the county attorney may have more updated information in your area.
County Attorney Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative, we would say that is where they're starting. When we're finding them, it's very, very difficult for those persons to report and be detected at that age. I'm looking at the chief of my criminal division. The victims that have had the ability to testify have absolutely started at that age. We're seeing anywhere from 15-year-olds, I think 14-year-olds is the youngest victim that we have identified, and up in their early 40s, but persons who have been in the life absolutely since that age.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk just a little bit about the demographics of a buyer? I had a recent conversation with an executive director of the group that kind of rescues people out of sex trafficking, and I just said, well, who's buying sex? And so I'm not going to say her answer, but I'd love to hear yours.
Okay.
County Attorney Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. White, middle-aged, married, employed men with children on their lunch break.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for saying that. So the person I talked to was more metro, and so there may be a difference in St. Cloud, because that's kind of the population of St. Cloud, too. But she was saying that it's just men. That's all she could say, because it was, 17 years old to 80 years old. It was every race, every economic strata. It was across all spectrum. And I said, how did we get there? And she said, well, because there's such a prevalence of consumption of pornography at a very young age, 10, 11, 12 years old, there's consumption of pornography. So by the time they're 17, 18, there's a corrupted and skewed view of what sex is, and so they're pursuing the violent things that they see in pornography. So that was her story to me. I just kind of want to hear what you think about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I would say the one connection with race, as was referenced, is that the connection is money, right? It's men who have money. And we know that there are disparities in society where although there's money all over the place, there is an economic aspect of that. So you're correct, it's men. It's men of all different backgrounds, of certainly all different races and ethnicities, et cetera, but the one commonality is men with money. And I would actually connect our discussion here with the prior connection, Representative Moeller's bill. There is a sense that men are entitled to do what they want with women. I mean, so you made the point about pornography. I think there's a connection there, but I think more broadly, this sense of objectification and the sense of that sergeant feeling that he could do to that, and I obviously don't know that case of what I heard from Representative Moeller's presentation, but that sense that men are entitled to do what they want. And there is a sense of, I have money, I have my desires, and as some of the comments and some of the trainings that I do for law enforcement, there's comments that are put up online and some of the sites that actually will rate human beings to buy and sell, just like an Amazon with restaurants and hotels. You can actually rate a human being, and it talks about lots of body parts and size and shapes and various things, and there's comments. And it says, for that, she may be a nice person with hopes and dreams, but for that half hour, I'm entitled to do what I want because I have money. And so that sense of entitlement that men tend to have, and so to be treating one another as full human beings, to my mind, that's a connection.
A final comment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Hero. I appreciate your indulgence, and it's, as you can tell, I'm pretty passionate about this too, and I think it's really important that we start to somehow change the trajectory of culture and what's acceptable, as you just stated, about the gender differences, and sometimes it's not even gender differences, because I know folks that are in, that are trans and, the gender nonconforming, and they also are heavily targeted, so it's not just that, but and as I said, there's boys that are also trafficked, so it's across the genders, but I think that we need to take a stand today and say enough is enough, and I think this bill does that, so it's a step in the right direction. There's a whole lot more to do, And I don't know how we get there, but I'm interested in the work. So thank you for this work and moving it forward.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Miller, I jumped over you. I apologize. You were the first one, and
no
obviously
problem.
you've been involved in the development of good policy in this arena. And so I'm calling on you, but members, we are keeping a very good pace, so let's keep pacing. We have a couple more bills, including a very important bill by Representative O'Neill. I really want to make sure we give that a really strong airing before we're done today. But Representative Miller, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a brief question for Ms. Kendall, but before I say that, just a quick comment. I have worked with Ms. Kendall and Chief Bentrud on that, and I'm honored to be a part of that in the past. They do incredible work in Stearns County, and I know that Representative Pinto, you do great work in Ramsey County, and I'm sure there are some other counties, but this leads to my question, because I long for the day when we have multiple county attorneys coming in and articulating this as aggressively and as straightforward as you do, Ms. Kendall. But my question to you is, when I talk to some of these people in other counties, we have these strong penalties, but then I find out that there's pleas or there's motions or there's things that happen to where, so like, Mr. Chair, just for understanding, I did a lot of work with Safe Harbor No Wrong Door. And in that, I think everyone agrees that children should not be solicited and someone who's buying a minor should suffer the full consequence of the law. And yet I find out in many counties that's still not happening. And if that's not happening, then in those counties, the trafficking is happening all the more. And as great a job as you do in Stearns County, that concerns me all the more that they just get pushed into the other counties, right? The work gets pushed to other places. So my question to you, Ms. Kendall, is with this beef up, because I've been asking for this for a while, this beef up in laws and prosecution, is it going to toughen up that back end also to where there's pleas, motions, whatever the technical terms are, to where when I find out that someone who solicited especially a minor, but certainly an adult too, doesn't just quote unquote get away with it.
County Attorney Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a matter of being able to get an investigation where you can prove it, mm-hmm. and then once you get that, knowing what to do with it. And we have found that the expertise, the pre-existing expertise that, as you know, we had in domestic violence has been critical to our ability to prosecute these cases. Because our law enforcement people are extremely trained up on domestic violence cases, they approach these victims as victims just like they would in that case, and we get better investigations because they aren't centered on the victim's testimony or even ability to testify. We know how to use expert witnesses. Our cops know how to put it together. So by the time it comes to us, we have a lot better case to move forward and testify. And that is one of the areas that we're now seeing spreading. And as again, Ramsey County started the training to law enforcement on how do you do this. We do get calls from other counties and other jurisdictions on here's what I have in the investigation. Now where do I begin on this? So we have been sharing information a lot more often as time has gone on. With other prosecutors. I believe Chief Bentrud and his colleagues have also been sharing that expertise with other counties. So like anything that is new to the mainstream, we're getting there, and we have really made progress since he first told me that my victims were in his files. I didn't believe him. And when you, as you get over that disbelief that this actually happens in your community, we're really making significant progress. It's just taking time because it's hard.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. And County Attorney Kendall, I'm really struck by it, and thank you for describing it so descriptively and powerfully, the connection, the need to connect, learning, training, sharing with strong, beefed up consequences that emanate from our legislative bodies. And it seems to me that doing one without the other is not as good as doing them both together. So thank you for that that learning here today. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you started your opening, you started talking about the different task force. There was one that was very active in South Central Minnesota, but you didn't mention them. Are they still active and up and running?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Constantine, I spoke with some of the folks, so I think you know Mark Chatterton and others, at a conference in November, and I think that they are somewhat active. So there's been, I actually had wanted to comment on this anyway for folks on the committee to realize. So there was first ever statewide state funding to support local investigations of trafficking that we initiated in 2015, and that was greatly expanded, but it's still quite limited. And so it's so there were a number of task forces that applied for funding. There is some funding that comes to Central Minnesota Human Trafficking Task Force, Southwest, I forget the name of the task force, Representative Constantine, that they refer to it, but in your area, has not, I know that they've applied, have not been funded, and I would strongly support there being increased funding for those task forces to provide support for them as well. Because I think that they are somewhat operating, but of course it's hard without that state support.
Chair Constantine.
I would strongly suggest we support them too. I'd like to have that task force up and running in our area. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Pinto, funding and resources from the state do matter.
They, Mr. Chair, they certainly do.
Very well. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, Section 5 on line 3.18, I'll give you a second. And I'm going to ask Mr. Diebel to jump in on this, too.
Very well.
Can I just say that I'm offended by calling these human refuse people patrons? What in the name of God are we doing calling these people patrons? When you go to a restaurant or you go to a museum, you're a patron. This is not patronage. These people are scum, and we should change that name, if you would, Representative Pinto, to find something that we can call them that appropriately represents what kind of filth they are.
I think I sense an amendment coming, but
thank you.
I might be a little worked up about this, but I'm sorry, but that's just offensive.
But I'm wondering, Representative Pinto, if there is a legal attachment to that.
Well, so Mr. Chair, and to confirm, so this is the term that's currently in statute, and it's a horrible term. I'll notice that there's some other ones too. The victims are referred to as prostitutes, I believe, and there's a number of other pieces there. I should say that the statewide human trafficking task force, which is a little bit distinctive from the investigative task forces that we've talked about, the one that Representative Constantine referred to in this group, has actually been looking at revising the statute for some time, including the language, Representative Nash. And the concern, so the hope, I will say, from a number of us, is to stop treating the people who are being exploited, because remember that under the same provisions that you find offensive in terms of language, also right now criminalize being a victim. So if you are being sold for sex, selling yourself for sex, but in my view is an exploitive position to be in where you are being sexually violated, where money happens to be involved, that's a situation where currently that is a crime under Minnesota state law. And so the thought has been that at some point we need to be redoing how we approach this issue as a whole. And I feel like the language has gotten kind of blocked up in connection with that. It may well make some sense. I mean, I'll be honest, part of my concern with changing the language along the way has been that you'd hate to make that language change and then not make that more fundamental and more important change in terms of how we actually treat it under the law. And maybe that's something that we should talk about. Maybe there would be the appetite for doing that. But I agree with you, Representative Nash. They're horrible terms. They've been in our statutes for years, and they're awful.
And I suspect, Representative Nash, and this, I'm just thinking of a conversation I had with Representative O'Neill at the beginning of last year, that part of what you're touching on is an old way of thinking that someone, I think one of the testifiers spoke about, maybe it was you, Representative Pinto, about people feeling, men in particular, feeling entitled to do what they want with women. And I think our language, you know, reflects, you know, those, you know, concepts that we reject now. And so certainly having our language move along as we move along with, you know, the substance of the law is an appropriate thing to do.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. If I can help with an amendment, I might be a little passionate, so let's get going on that. But so let's drop down to lines 3.27 to 3.29, where for a repeat offender within 10 years of a previous conviction is now only going to get slapped on the wrist with a five-year felony. I don't know if you all ever saw the movie Spinal Tap, but can we turn that up to 11, perhaps? Can we dial that up some? Because again, I'm not going to call them a patron, but they should just rot from my perspective. So let's put them away for a really long time, can we?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Nash, to confirm, this would be someone who is purchasing sex from an adult, which right now would potentially be a misdemeanor. This would convert it to a level 4 felony, which is a, so if you look at the sentencing guidelines grid, so we certainly could do it a higher level felony. It's not necessary. So this is not buying from a child, to be clear. This would be buying sex from an adult. This would make that a felony for what would be the first time. So we'd have to just assess. I mean, it's bad news, and we could potentially go to a higher than a level 4 felony. I'm not sure if the county attorney may have a comment about that. Because that's a number of offenses. So, for example, felony domestic assault, et cetera, these are all level 4 offenses. But county attorney, you have thoughts about that?
County attorney, can we?
That's basically, we put it on par with the domestics. And if you're a frequent flyer and you're back here repeatedly, at least now we can make it a felony. Right now it's just a misdemeanor, depending on where you do it, a gross misdemeanor in another place. So this would be giving us the ability to deal with felonies. Because what you're describing and what you're describing is absolutely what we see. So they don't even think they're going to get caught. Can you imagine how many times they've done it if we've caught them 3 times?
Mm-hmm. Representative Pinto, I note that on page 5 in section 9, there's a directive to our Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I assume this is about aligning the grid to assuming that the language here of raising the penalty, that we align that. But I'm wondering if that might not also offer an opportunity for us to speak to the Guidelines Commission about diving in a little deeper into what might be a just term in the guidelines grid?
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I think you're right, level Section 9 would do that, although I will note, per Representative Nash's point, that once we set it at a 5-year imprisonment, $10,000 fine, that kind of is the general standard for a level 4 felony. So I would expect the sentencing guidelines would slot it in at a level 4, if you sort of look at the guidelines in that way. So this would direct the Guidelines Commission to do it, but I think it'd be pretty clear where they would end up slotting it. And again, this is purchasing sex from an adult, just to be clear in terms of what this is talking about. Still an offensive act, but different in our minds probably than purchasing sex from a child.
Indeed. Members, I do want to keep moving. We do have questions for Representative Johnson and then Representative Miller, and you'll have the last word, and then we'll move forward. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Pinto, you have the repealer in here, and I've had some people contact me with some concerns that with this repealer, it could actually end up making prostitution no longer being a crime for prostitution. Can you explain that a little bit, to what the repealer actually does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just reminding ourselves about. The criminal division chief may be able to comment on this question.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, chief.
Thank you, Your Honor. Only tweeting. I'm sorry. Used to court. Thank you, Chair. Only tweeting, chief of the criminal division. And Representative, I think the repealer only refers to the misdemeanor portion of the patron or John or whatever crude term we want to use. It does not refer to the victim side of this. So it would be repealing that misdemeanor portion, replacing it with either a gross misdemeanor or a felony for any John or purchasing of sex.
Why don't we hear quickly from House Counsel, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson and members, as Representative Nash indicated, the prostitution-related statutes are rather complicated. There's an extensive history that I won't give you all right now. But there are separate subdivisions that deal with offenses for people acting as prostitutes and those who are acting as sex buyers. The offense that relates to someone who's acting as a prostitute, what they call the general prostitution crimes, is in subdivision 7, which does not appear in the bill because there's no change to that. So that is not repealed. What is repealed is the portion that relates to what in statute is called patrons, what sometimes people refer to as sex buyers. That is the subdivision that's being repealed. So prostitution engaged in by a person who is considered a prostitute would not be decriminalized by removing this. It simply removes the misdemeanor penalty related to what we refer to as patrons, because in Section 5 of the bill, that misdemeanor penalty is replaced by a gross misdemeanor penalty.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank the Mr. Johnson for the clarification. Like I said, I've had a few people contact me, and we had some concerns about this. I want to get the Johns and the pimps off the street, put them in jail where they belong. If there's victims involved, get them the help they need. But I do not want to legalize prostitution at all.
Representative Johnson, this bill appears not to do that at all, so I'm glad that we had that airing out here in public. Representative Miller, you get the last word here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, really, it's just a brief punctuation on what's being said here for the people of this committee to understand. I do appreciate the way that we're talking about this in this committee, and it appears this bill is going to move forward and have strong bipartisan support. Representative Nash referred to him a lot of different names. I know that the people in this room have heard me referred to the people who are buying as middle-aged perverts is the phrase that I typically use. And I want you to understand something, because it is a lot of people that we've heard have been the middle-aged business men that have been doing this. And it's really bothered me that they, in my opinion, generally get away with this. And we need to toughen this. One of the things that I've heard from Ms. Kendall, I've heard, not from her, but she has expressed this, that some people say this, that these guys who are soliciting, remember they're soliciting down to 12, 13 years old, they say, well, you're going to be destroying their career and their family if you prosecute them. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, what Representative Nash said, I agree. I don't care. I encourage people to watch, if they get a chance on Netflix, there's a documentary called I Am Jane Doe. And it kind of goes through the story of three young women who were trafficked and how it not only affects that person, but their family and everyone around them. This is just a destructive thing that we're dealing with here. This goes well beyond something that's terrible and heinous to that individual person, but this is destructive to our society. This is something where we need to hold the line. And so I really do appreciate this bill. And I trust you a lot, Ms. Kendall. You know that when it comes to the law, because I fire questions at you. And you say, well, here's why we can and can't do that. You're very articulate with that, so I have a lot of confidence that the two of you participated in this and helping draft this. So thanks a lot, Representative Pinnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple brief comments. I want to thank the testifiers and thank my co-authors, Representatives Miller and Mueller. When you have Miller and Mueller coming together, that's a good thing going. And to thank Representative O'Neill's point, because I actually do think it's important to go back to it about the fact that there are boys and transgender, that although I go back to the gender issues on this because they're really fundamental, and yet there are so many boys and transgender individuals, and you said non-gender conforming as well, are caught up in this. And the final point is just to say that I would love to amend the language, and so love to talk to Representative Nash on that. I want to make sure, as long as it doesn't get held against any future broader rewriting of this, because I think that this is an area that really needs to be rewritten more broadly. And in the meantime, if we can stop using this horrible language in the meantime, that would be great too. So thank you so much to everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash, very
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, I'm going to take you up on that. We've never actually worked on anything together, but I've just added myself onto your bill. And I'm ready to swing for the fences.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash.
Representative Pinto and members, and I caught the Chief's earlier reference to action that our body took several years ago, and that would have been under a different majority at that time. And so I think what this conversation and that reflection for me really says is that there is incredible common ground here across our parties, and there's absolutely no reason why this legislation should not be successful. And it's certainly my intent as chair of this committee to move this forward powerfully this year. We're laying it over only because we don't have a fiscal note as of yet, and so we want to make sure that as we move forward, we're aligning. We don't even have a target yet. We're aligning the resources that are available for us. I am noting that resources most likely will be needed, and so we've got to be able to walk and talk both in the policy and the resource side simultaneously to continue the good work of people up in Stearns County and other counties as well. So thank you to the chiefs. Thank you to the county attorney for being with us today. And Representative Pinto, the chair At this point, moves House File 3070 to be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. With that, members, we have two bills left, and the next bill is actually the next two bills are Representative O'Neill's bills. So please come forward, Representative O'Neill. House File 464, and members, we heard this bill last year. It was one of the bills, frankly, we could not move across the finish line. We got awfully close. But this bill, I have to say, as opposed to just trying to move it through in 30 seconds, I think anyway, and I think Representative O'Neill agrees, its significance is pretty important in terms of how the state makes powerful investments in work that needs to happen. And so I wanted to have an opportunity for the community of people who have been working with Representative O'Neill and others to come forward and share their hopes and their thoughts, you know, a little bit of information. I would ask members, because we did hear the bill, however, to primarily spend our time listening as opposed to raising questions and comments, because then that will give us the opportunity to move on to House File 2983, which is a vitally important bill. And I want to make sure we get that done before we adjourn here today. Representative O'Neill, your motion is to refer House File 464 to Ways and Means, and I believe you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A1.
And that's a technical amendment, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's technical. It's just removing the fiscal year that no longer we can fund. So.
Very well. Mm-hmm. Representative O'Neill moves House File 464, be referred to Ways and Means, and she moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 464 is before us as amended. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this is creating a grant program for domestic abuse transformation programs, and it's administered through the OJP programs. It's $5 million for the year 2021. And with that, I'm just going to let them talk.
Yep, very well.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Chair Mariani, members of the committee, I'm Katie Kramer, Policy Director for Violence-Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse, formerly the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. After 40 years as the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, it was time to update our name to reflect the vision we work towards every day, a violence-free Minnesota. We remain a statewide coalition with 90 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victim survivors in all 87 Minnesota counties. I'm here today in support of HF 464, seeking funding for programming to transform the behavior of domestic violence perpetrators. Minnesota has a long history of financially supporting domestic violence work. Domestic violence services are a critical core function of Minnesota state government because of the vital part these programs play in ensuring public safety. But despite the state's commitment to funding for domestic violence services, programs in Minnesota continue to have unmet needs and face funding uncertainty. While the need for continued and increased support for crisis intervention services is critical, in order to end domestic violence, we must invest in prevention work as well. This work includes community education, healthy relationships trainings with youth, as well as programming to transform abusive behaviors and end the cycle of violence. We recognize that this is not a funding year, but should there be money available in the supplemental budget, we are asking for an investment in programming to transform domestic violence perpetrator behavior. We need a system that has accountability, monitoring, and effective and accessible programming for those who harm others. With me today are staff from three member programs, as well as a program graduate, to talk about the programming they offer for perpetrators of violence. Here to talk about the success of their programming for veterans and the need for funding wildly is Amirthany Keefe, Director of Client Services with the Domestic Abuse Project. DAP received one-time funding for veterans programming last session. This is an example of one type of transformational programming, and I'm going to turn it off to you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Keith. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Amadini Keith. So good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As I said, my name is Amadini Keith. I'm the Director of Client Services at the Domestic Abuse Project. So first, we wanted to start by thanking you for the dedicated funding for Change Step. Those resources have allowed us to open up a full-time Change Step position, with the goal of expanding our programming and doubling the number of clients that we have historically served. It's also providing an opportunity for us to expand our services to partners and children of service members. Today, I'm here to speak in support of the House File Bill for Transforming Program Funding. As you know, about 3 years ago, United Way categorically cut funding to domestic violence programs. This was a major source of funding for DAP and resulted in a significant reduction in our workforce over the last 3 years. The collateral impact in the community was a significant decrease in our accessibility to community members and partners. While we possess the space to serve, staff that are very passionate and dedicated to working with a specific population, and 4 decades of experience in engaging in this work, we can only do so much with the staffing that we have. In the last year, DAP sent 185 participants through our intervention and prevention program. Unfortunately, this past year, we also received calls from 426 other potential participants who were interested in services and who we had to refer out to community partners. While our program is clearly effective, given that more than 95% of our graduates consistently remain violence-free when measured 1 year post-graduation, it is devastating to not be able to serve more. Our sister and brother organizations are struggling similarly and don't always have the capacity to accept the referrals that we are offering them. There is a need for culturally specific programs from folks from diverse backgrounds and communities, services for immigrants and refugees for whom English is not a primary language, programs for adolescents, and programs for folks from the LGBTQ community who silently struggle due to the lack of mental health providers who can understand the domestic violence dynamics that are experienced in non-traditional relationships. DAP has long believed that one of the most effective interventions for ending domestic violence is investing in those who use violence themselves. Victim services are absolutely necessary. However, victims cannot be expected to shoulder the responsibility for the violence that's committed upon them. As a community, we need to change this narrative and our expectations for change. One way for us to do that as a state is by investing in domestic abuse transformation program funding so that we can invest in every member of the family in all of our communities. To share a more personal perspective, I'd like to introduce Addison, who is a recent program graduate from DAP.
Welcome to the committee, Addison. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Addison Marantes, and thank you to the members of the committee for this opportunity. I recently graduated the men's program at the Domestic Abuse Program, DAP. While at DAP, not only was I educated on the cycle of domestic abuse and the detrimental ramifications it can cause in the home, it helped me break free from unhealthy core belief systems and rebuild better ones. The program has shown me a model in which I can use effective communication styles with a romantic companion and to put the knowledge and skills into practical practice in all aspects of my life. Today, I am in a wonderful relationship with my current partner based on honesty and trust. Before DAP, I felt intense guilt and shame. Through my programming, I was able to work through that pain and moving forward, be an advocate against domestic violence, willing to share my experience, strength, and hope to anyone who seeks it. Domestic violence can be prevented. Awareness isn't enough. Additional funding to programs like DAP is required for prevention education. The Domestic Violence Transformation Programs Bill is a vital step to creating a healthier and safer Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity and your cooperation and consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Marantis, and we applaud and honor your growth and learning and wish you continued well wishes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So next we have Brittany Wadowitz, who's the Assistant Director of the Committee Against Domestic Abuse in Mankato. She will provide an example of another type of transformational programming, one that has received no state dollars. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Brittany Wadowitz. Thank you for your time today. I want to share a story about the importance of domestic abuse transformation programming to families. After years of emotional abuse that eventually turned physical, a mom and her 2 kids came to Kata's shelter. However, the children's father continued to harass her using the kids as leverage. She finally decided she would not let him come back into their lives if he didn't change. He went to therapy, but it didn't address his abusive behavior. Other programming wasn't accessible to him at the time. 2 years later, the only contact the kids have with their dad is over the phone, and he continues to use these conversations to harass the kids' mom. She had to accept that he would not change and still grieves the missed opportunity when her kids ask why their dad didn't come home. So at CADA, we provide safety and support to victims of domestic and sexual violence through education, advocacy, and shelter throughout Region 9. In 2015, we started the Southern Minnesota Offender Education Program for men who use violence in relationships to increase safety for victims and to address the need mentioned in the story, the opportunity to choose differently for one's family. This program is completely funded by the fees that participants pay. We are one of the only agencies in our region that offers this type of programming. We have seen a 38% increase in referrals. Participants come mostly from Blue Earth County, though we have seen increased referrals from our rural counties as well. Our class sizes became unmanageable, and we restructured the program to meet the needs. Even so, we've had a wait list of up to 18 participants long. During this time, 7 of the participants on the wait list reoffended. We've seen changes when men are able to attend programming. We have heard victims express cautious optimism when he seems different. However, we have also had victims tell us that the burden for payment of group has fallen on them. Some participants travel an hour or more each week to get to group, which impacts their ability to work or put gas in their vehicle. We have been told that some criminal cases go to a plea deal in order to avoid having to go to Mankato for programming. These things ultimately fall back on the victim as well. Our program has reached its capacity. We would like to increase access to programming by changing the fee structure or offering additional classes in our rural areas. We cannot do this with our current lack of funding and ask you to consider supporting this measure. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we have Margie Rask, who's the Vice President of Programs at Eastside Neighborhood Services, to talk about another form of transformational programming, again, one that receives no state dollars.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Margie Rask. I'm at Eastside Neighborhood Services in Northeast Minneapolis. My comments are brief because there's been so much testimonial and impact statements already that I can echo in regards to what we see in our neighborhoods as well. But I just want to give you a little more insight in regards to our group, what happens, and the transformational process. People come to our group either through self-referral or court mandate. They come from all backgrounds, ages, races, as we've heard in previous testimonies in regards to this topic. They come because they have been identified as using abusive behaviors within their home or community and have a mandated hours of program to complete. We understand the need for transformational programming as we have seen its positive results because we've talked here today about old models flipping to new. This is another example of what we have seen. Previously, programs have been shame-based, punishment-based, ignoring the trauma that offenders themselves have experienced, which then has developed into maladaptive behaviors. Families, communities, and society also reinforce toxic masculinity and retribution as acceptable behaviors. Today, the program is grounded in healing. Healing services, which instead of asking what's wrong with you, we ask what's happened to you. We use motivational interviewing, cognitive behavior therapy, and use common language and empower participants with discussion and understanding the cycle of abuse. Participants take from the group responsibility for their own thoughts and actions that may have caused harm to others. Effective practice for taking timeouts when stress levels begin to escalate. Develop positive self-talk and affirmations and understand their impact, which they've had from their abusive behaviors on their relationships with family and community. Our current evaluation within the last 6 months shows that participants are highly satisfied with what they're learning and they are beginning to mentor others around them and in their networks. They have increased understanding of their own self-awareness and behaviors and thoughts, and 20 out of the recent 20 have not reoffended. There is a great need for the service, as you've heard from us up here on the panel. We have wait lists as well of 1 to 4 weeks, and our groups are full. We cannot take any more without further funding. So there's need to fund these critical services. There is minimal funding out there for us to find together, so we're asking for you to support this bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yeah.
So these are just a few examples of the domestic violence specific programming happening in the state. So I know we're running short on time. I do want to take a moment to address what is in your packet. So you should have received a packet of a few colored photos Just wanted to walk through that. The first is a piece that walks you through the intersectional nature of domestic violence. So policies that impact domestic violence victim survivors will also impact things like homelessness, employment, health care, transportation. We know that domestic violence does not exist in isolation. The second is a map of the state, which shows what type of programming is available in which counties. So as you can see, hopefully you have the colored copies, but as you can see with the green on the map, only a third of Minnesota counties have programming that is specific to domestic violence. And even in those counties with domestic violence-specific programming, it's often one program for the full county. And as you can see from the map in the white, there are 40% of counties in Minnesota have nothing available. So clearly we lack sufficient access and quality programming across the state, which is why this funding is so needed. Third, we have a one-pager that answers some of the frequently asked questions around domestic abuse transformation programming, including effectiveness and levels of funding needed. So we ask you, our state legislators, as you look at criminal justice reforms this session, it's vital that there be an investment in transformation programming. The solution to domestic violence is not to lock away a perpetrator forever, and it's not to release them into the community without any programming. The solution is to promote programming that has been shown to transform behavior, to prevent future violence, to increase safety, and to save the lives of domestic violence victims and their children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kramer. And Chair Considine, I know your county was mentioned, and so I think you wanted to say something very quickly, but then I am going
to
move.
Very quickly, yes. To the woman from CADA, are you still able to take your program into the Blue Earth County Jail? We used to do that.
We do not take our offender programming into the jail. We occasionally do groups for women around survivor healing and things like that in the jail.
Thank you, Mr. Just a brief comment. I thought it was extremely helpful when I was the program coordinator and thought a number of the gentlemen got a lot out of it. So, yeah, it would be nice to see the funding back to a point where you can do that.
We just don't have the funding even really to do what we're doing now. We're pretty short-staffed in that, and so we do want the opportunity to expand if we have that possibility.
Thank you, Chair Costner. Representative O'Neill. Quick closing thoughts. You know, I'm really struck by this 40% of the counties, like, nothing available. And, you know, we have an opportunity, I think, here to really have a big impact in our state. I hope that we can be successful with your bill even yet this year, even though it's not a funding year. But quick closing thoughts.
Right. I think that would be incredibly important. And I think what's important to note, which may have already been mentioned, but I want to emphasize the fact that there are very few programs that help offenders stop the violence. And you really aren't going to stop the violence until you change the heart of the man that's, or women, but mostly it's men, perpetrating the violence. So I think this is an important step in that direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing it today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I want to thank all the testifiers. Again, I particularly wanted to thank the gentleman who came forward to share how he learned and has been learning and has grown your powerful testimony to work that makes our state safer. So thank you all for being with us here today. Representative O'Neill, the chair will now lay over House File 464. And Representative O'Neill, you have House File 2983. And your motion is to re-refer House File 2983 to the Committee on Ways and Means. So that motion is before us. And there's an author's amendment as well. I think it's a technical amendment, but I'll let you describe it super quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the A2 is technical. It was asked on behalf of the BCA to make things flow a little easier. So restricted kits, those are kits that the victim did not give their permission to be tested, would be direct shipped from the hospital directly to the BCA, and law enforcement would not have to pick it up because they don't need to. And so that's just making that clarification that that can happen. And I thank you for that.
Very well. Representative O'Neill moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. House File 2983 as amended is before us. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So So today is a historic day. I think this is an amazing opportunity for us to stand with victims and survivors of rape. This bill before us will be the first in Minnesota ever to say we are going to test each and every kit that a victim has given their permission to be tested. I have with me today Minkasa, who have been working with me on this bill, and the BCA, who I've worked with very, very closely to craft this so that it actually will work. It can work. It will get justice to victims that are not getting justice now. It will do so many different things. Let me just talk about the first part of it, about mandating testing all rape kits that are unrestricted. And in this room, we know what unrestricted is, but for the members of the public, it means a victim has given her permission to have that kit tested. Why is that important? Not only is it bringing justice to a woman that has had this kit done, but it also allows law enforcement, and there are over 400 different unique law enforcement agencies right here in Minnesota, to connect the dots where they could not connect them now. If that DNA exists and they can load it to CODIS, the national database for DNA, they can see hits all over. So they can see something in Ramsey County, in Clearwater County, in Menominee County, in Hennepin County. They can see hits all over the state of Minnesota. They can also see hits not just related to sexual assault, but you're going to be interested to find out that also home invasions and burglaries are also associated with rape. You will see the same DNA in those cases as well. We could close cases across the state, both in rape cases and in home invasions and burglary cases, if we could load this information into CODIS. So this is historic. This is amazing, and I just am so excited to stand with victim survivors today, and so much so that I need to tell you that since I've introduced this bill, there now are 23 co-authors, both Republican and Democrat, on this bill in the House, and it has full. You can only take five in the Senate, so that's their thing, but they have it full in the Senate. And I want to especially thank Representative Mueller, who's been working with me and helping me on this and has collaborated with me. The other parts of the bill. So a restricted kit, a kit that a victim has not given her permission to test, will be centrally stored at the BCA. No more lost kits, no more counting of kits, no more wondering where it is and if it's been destroyed. So those kits will now go directly to the BCA. They'll be logged in and tracked. I have a retention period for 30 months for a restricted kit. So this is one that the victim did not give her permission to. When we were doing a working group in the past, there was an agreement at 18 months, and I felt that wasn't nearly long enough. 30 months would give that victim two anniversary dates plus 6 months to make her decision. Does she want to pursue the case? Now, I'm certainly open to holding it longer, but maybe we'll have to talk to the BCA about that side of it. But for right now, we're going to hold it for 30 months and get notice out to them to make sure that they know that that kit will be potentially destroyed if she doesn't convert it to a case. The last part, we're going to do a database to track all of the kits, and it will be accessible to the victim online. So the victim can go in, log in, check to see where her kit is and what activity that is, information that she can have available to her. Also, if she has a restricted kit, so a kit that she didn't get permission to test, she can convert that in that database on that online to say, I'm going to go from a restricted kit to an unrestricted kit and start the process, and that information will get back to law enforcement so that they can also start the case. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers who have so graciously come to tell us more. So should we go to the Minkasa?
Very well, welcome. Who's going to go first?
You're going to hear from both of us. I'm Lindsay Bryce. I've testified in front of, well, this is my first time this session in front of this committee, but I've testified in front of this committee a number of times last year. I'm Minkasa's Law and Policy Director. I've worked with and for victims and survivors of gender-based violence since about the mid-90s. And I'm a former prosecutor. But I'll back up. The Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault provides leadership and resources for sexual assault programs and allies across the state in order to prevent sexual violence while promoting a comprehensive, socially just response for all victims and survivors. And I just really appreciate all of the time and attention I'm hearing today of that you're giving to all of these different bills that really impact the lives of survivors. I sit here before you today as MnCASA continues over a decade worth of work towards comprehensive reform of medical forensic compliance in Minnesota. I've been part of this work in my role for only about a year and a half. There are a number of people who have worked on this for many, many years at and through MnCASA. And when you're working on medical forensic compliance, you eventually reach the issues related to sexual assault kits. Extensive efforts in 2018, created a right for survivors to access information such as the date their sexual assault kit was sent to the lab, the date the agency received the results, whether there was a DNA profile ever obtained. But that information is really difficult for victim survivors to obtain. I'm sure that you've all seen, there's been so much media around this issue, and that there's some really compelling stories out in the media specifically related to how difficult that information is for folks to obtain. In 2018, in large part due to a lack of consensus around centralized storage, which I'm really excited to hear we've overcome, and we have consensus now today, and we could not create a tracking system or a retention period at that point. So MnCASA's priority this session is this bill. Centralized storage and tracking and a statewide consent form are really our primary goal this session. We absolutely support testing all unrestricted kits as well, and we understand it's a budget year. So we understand that there may be some conversation about dollars around that. I would note that the same 2018 legislation that allows survivors to gain information about their kit also requires prosecution and law enforcement to work together and in any determination around any unrestricted kit that is not tested. So anytime there's a decision made to not test a kit, there's a requirement that be documented. Well, right now, that data sits essentially in law enforcement or prosecution files. It's not in a place that we can actually utilize that data in Minnesota. So if Minnesota doesn't choose to go forward and test all unrestricted kits, then we need to make sure we're collecting that data through this tracking system. I was going to stop myself here and explain what a restricted and unrestricted kit was, but you all know that, and you've already explained that, so I'll turn it over to Jude.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jude Foster. I have over 25 years of experience in victim advocacy, and I am currently the statewide medical forensic policy program coordinator at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault and the Sexual Violence Justice Institute. The statewide medical forensic policy program works on training, technical assistance, and public policy. We also are currently working on the statewide Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, or SAKI project, with our partners at the BCA, the Minnesota Office of Justice Programs. We are currently in Anoka County, so we are working with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office and Attorney's Office, the Alina Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program, and Alexandra House, which is a victim services agency. One of the goals of the SAKI project is we move from community to community. It's not just about testing those kits. We are really trying to identify the barriers in investigations in the criminal justice system and to really make sure that we're not repeating those patterns so we don't end up in the same situation that we were in 2015 when the BCA did a inventory of kits across the state. So in preparing this testimony, Lindsay and I had some discussions about technical assistance. What is technical assistance? That is simply when people come to MnCASA and ask for help and guidance around issues. So I provide technical assistance to law enforcement, prosecutors, rural hospitals, sexual assault nurse examiners, and advocates. Most of my technical assistance calls are about general medical forensic response, including sexual assault exams, sexual assault submission to law enforcement, and the criminal justice response. Approximately 10% of my technical assistance since legislation was passed in 2018 are related to a lack of a statewide consent form releasing the kit to law enforcement from the victim survivor, and nearly 10% are related to sexual assault kit storage. We need statewide kit storage for restricted or unreported kits in a centralized location so that kits can be stored for 30 months and not destroyed due to inadequate storage in hospital and law enforcement agencies. I also provide quite a bit of technical assistance to multidisciplinary teams across the state. Many of them are in rural communities, and I'll give you a great example of what multidisciplinary teams are struggling with around sexual assault kit storage. Many law enforcement really view that kit that is restricted as not being evidence because it hasn't been reported to law enforcement yet. Many, many hospitals do see that kit as evidence or potential evidence. So what ends up happening is both of those disciplines don't see themselves as the appropriate agency to store that kit. So many kits end up being stored in hospitals that have very limited and inadequate storage space. So what happens is many of those restricted kits are being destroyed at 3 and 6 months. This is, in addition to that issue, has eroded many multidisciplinary relationships that took years to build. And if we are fighting each other, we are not working for victim survivors. So legislation passed in 2018 made a commitment to victim survivors to have access to current information about their kit. And as you've seen in the news, there is no mechanism for victim survivors to know the status of their kits. So in conclusion, I just want to share with you that we really believe that centralized kit storage and a statewide tracking system will increase victim survivors' faith in the criminal justice system. It gives us the opportunity to provide transparency and accountability. It can avoid future surprise backlogs, and it can ensure quick and effective audit.
Mr. Chair, members, just briefly, I want to talk about...
Excuse me, just one moment. Sorry, thank you. We're going to only go for 10 more minutes, so if you could keep it brief, because I do want to hear from Director Evans as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. Just very briefly, I want to talk through why MnCUSA supports the testing of all-run restricted kits. Obviously, I don't need to emphasize, or I can't overemphasize, the powerful message that sends to survivors. It's crucial from that perspective. It's also crucial from a variety of other perspectives. It's crucial, one of the things we hear is it doesn't need to be tested because we know who the alleged offender is. Maybe the only issue in the case is consent. Whether or not consent exists. And as you heard Representative O'Neill say, one of the reasons that's important is it because it does link up with other, there are links with other cases. It's also crucial because evidence gathered from those sexual assault kits, when that forensic evidence is actually evaluated, it often corroborates the victim's story or exonerates the suspect, right? It can do either, but it provides crucial information to that in that case. Just briefly, federal best practices. You have two documents from us in your packets. You have a legislative policy agenda from MnCUSA. Then you have this document that says sexual assault kits. MnCUSA must standardize the processing. I think you received it electronically. Federal best practices calls for the testing of all unrestricted sexual assault kits, and there's a link to that document in the document that you received from us. There's also evidence that indicates that communities save fairly substantial amounts of money by testing all unrestricted kits and having appropriate investigation and prosecution of offenders. There's some links in that information you received also that backs up some of that detail. In conclusion, it's fair to say that victims and the public both expect and deserve thorough investigation and prosecution of criminal sexual conduct cases. When a survivor chooses to engage with the criminal justice system, it's crucial that we support that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Very true. Director Evans. Go ahead and state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Drew Evans. I am the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I'm happy to be in front of you today to offer our support for the great work that's being done here. I want to thank Representative O'Neill and Representative Moeller and other members that have signed on to this bill. I think it's an important step forward in terms of building on some of the important work we've been doing. I'd also like to thank the coalitions, MnCASA and Violence Free Minnesota, and all the other advocacy groups that worked very diligently on some of these issues with our law enforcement partners from the Law Enforcement Coalition. This bill really solves some of those tougher issues that builds upon the work that you've passed in the most recent years. And one of those being centralized storage of these restricted kits. As I think you've heard from a number of different people, the practices vary across Minnesota. Law enforcement certainly supports retention of these kits in terms of if they are reported to law enforcement, they want to make sure that the evidence obviously is there in a manner in which we can process the case appropriately and pursue justice in these cases. The challenge becomes is that it hadn't been reported to law enforcement, so there's varying views on how those kits would be stored. And in addition, there's just a capacity issue in terms of doing this. So we're happy to partner in this respect so that we can store these kits so that they are available should a victim, a survivor come forward and convert that kit and report to law enforcement. The other thing that's been noted here, I think that's really important, we certainly agree that DNA is an extremely powerful tool. And any time that a kit is going to provide answers in a case or, as was noted, can connect other cases to provide answers and connect law enforcement certainly is going to support that premise. So the more testing that we see in these cases certainly can link other cases. I will tell this committee, since you passed the most recent legislation related to sexual assault kits, restricted and unrestricted, we've seen a significant increase in the number of kits. So law enforcement, working with their prosecutors across Minnesota, has certainly turned in a lot more kits than they did in the past, and they're seeing they're following that law that all of you passed to get those answers in these cases. In fact, we're currently at 120-day turnaround time and just got for those examination kits, and that's due to the significant increase in the number of kits that's coming into our laboratory, in addition to the work we're doing on the number of kits that we're working that was noted here on the sexual assault examination kit grants that we're working on across the state. The other piece on this, the tracking kit, I just want to note for this committee as well, we believe that it's very necessary as part of that unrestricted kit storage so that we ensure at the BCA that these kits are tracked in a way that we can then notify law enforcement, we can make sure that we're destroying them appropriately when they come up on the 30 months as outlined in this bill, and also for those unrestricted kits, I certainly believe it builds accountability into our system by providing a lens through both law enforcement, prosecutor, victims, hospitals, and everybody involved in the process so they can see the status of that kit at all times in the process. And so I think there's some really good items here. I, again, appreciate the work that's being done by this committee and others. I think this is a good step forward for Minnesota.
Thank you, Director. We are over our time. So we have two members with questions, and then Representative O'Neill will give you the last word. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to also thank Representative O'Neill for all your hard work on this bill, to Mr. Evans, Superintendent Evans, to MnCASA, and to all of those who are supporting this. I also wanted to acknowledge that there are many survivors in the audience today, and we're really, really thankful that they're here and have been advocating so hard on these issues. I'll just note, too, that many of us are wearing teal today. Teal is in recognition of sexual violence awareness. And so today we're not red, we're not blue, but we're teal. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for the hard work and all of the groups that have put time into this important legislation. So just a quick question for Director Evans. When I look at this, there's a requirement that your department creates a website for the front-end interface from the public and then a back-end database. In my conversation prior to this bill hearing with one of the advocacy groups, my understanding is that there's already similar technology in other states, so you're not going to be building something from scratch. I just wonder if you can confirm that.
Director Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, we think there's some solutions out there that are off the shelf that we would not have to create, correct?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's fantastic because we've had some recent history with government trying to create websites, and we don't want to recreate that. So that's good. And then just a point for maybe Representative O'Neill. I see in the lines 2.23 through 2.25, there is a direction by the Department of Public Safety to build, design, and maintain the database, but the website isn't in that last language. So just might want to add that. So thank you.
Representative O'Neill, no more questions. So if you want to go ahead and have the final words.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent. I just want to say I think it's time to test all, and I think we need to close the gap and give justice to those that have been waiting a very long time and to put serial rapists behind bars. It's just time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. We will lay House File 2983 over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. Members, we'll be meeting again tomorrow at 12:45.